Any more questions for Bob?
What you're talking about, Kurt, is kind of waste heat off the refrigeration unit.
Yeah, the refrigeration unit is necessary, a good bit of the school wouldn't want.
I'm sure that would be a problem.
I generate it. So that would be good as well.
Okay, yeah, all right, bye bye.
What we're looking at is the fact that at the time when we need refrigeration, we probably won't need heat. At the time we need heat, we won't need that refrigeration.
Well, I think we're on heat, so those of you.
Right.
Yeah, well, we generate heat in the hole.
Right.
And the head is, oh, people. And we can take advantage of the energy and all that.
Well, we thought about that. And I'm not sure. We gave the conclusion that we work with my friend would be work to do that. And work the effort because at the time we need refrigeration. So we want 60 degrees outside. We don't need much in the way of heat. Now it goes to storage aid, so you have all your available power in the refrigeration at that time. And at the time when you need heat, now it goes to storage, you have to be cold. You won't be using much of your power supply for generating cold food box, and you'll have available water box. So we're just going to use that to use.
Well, what does that mean, you said you're going to do?
I'm going to have to actually put it. We can generate the climate source. Now, I have a bank of batteries back at the present. Well, wind blows in amber about 30% of the time, strong enough to charge up the generator, to charge the batteries. When the batteries are discharged, we'll have the option to do 5 to 7 per minute, or just switching over the air. Probably switching over the air, if you want to do it. So then when you're operating expenses we have, on the facility will be to purchase power at the time so you don't have enough batteries and to maintain the system and eventually to replace the air bubbles such as compressor pumps and water. Potential compressor pumps are that's quite a lot.
It really is there though. How long is it going to
work? That's the thing. There's one, with only one power supply needed. Run the village's needs for freezing. If the main power supply were to go out, a portable generator could operate this facility. Whereas if the village has 50 home freezers and the system goes out, it's practically impossible to get 50 portable generators big enough each to run a home freezer.
Is that about including girls at White Hall? Freeze down for about -6. Is there another troops back up?
I'd rather put my money in the batteries. I can recharge the batteries. Yeah, I
you have 50 barrels. These regular ones put light bulb in too much.
That's what you're talking about, the use of detective brine in
that's
either brine or light bulb is easier to get colder.
I thought about it.
That's
since you guys are already doing it right now, I'd like to see how that works. Compared to what we want to do, one looks better than the other than us. I didn't include numbers in a whole lot. My cost is already being done down there.
I Can I summarize this, Mayor?
Yeah.
Okay. From this discussion, I think all of us have gathered, if you didn't know before, that one of our biggest single problems now, at least this next phase of development that we see, is a way to store food. See, there are essentially three phases we go through in agriculture. The first is, at least to a people who've never grown things before, the first is the step we've gone through is to get them to put seeds in the ground and raise something. Okay, generally this results in a little garden that produces fresh produce in season, and that's all it produces. And that's great, and people say, wow, look at this, we've got something to put on the table. But when freeze-up comes, that's it, and there's nothing else. Okay, the next phase after that is to get into what we call a production garden, a production and storage garden, where you raise enough of something, and you have a means of keeping it so that you keep it all year long. And so it doesn't feed the family just in season, but it feeds the family, say, a significant part of the year. Okay, this is the type of gardening that many people are doing down south. The next phase I see as commercial gardening or selling your produce. Now, we've come into the first phase. We've just started into the second phase. People are just now in our area, a few of them learning to put away things for the year. Potatoes where they can, freezing, some of the cooperative extension people, what's her name, Christy Long, over in Nome, has been over here, showed some of our villagers how to freeze things. And Lynn and his wife were doing that this summer. So we're trying to take our people through the logical teaching steps, if you will. And the thing that's stopping us right now is we are now getting more production we can use. And I watched a tremendous amount of vegetables go to waste this year because we're stopped. We just don't have the way to keep them. Sure, we've got the freezers, and there's some blanching and freezing done. But what we need now more than anything else is root cellars. And I hope you'll be that priority. Keeping in mind, too, what Bob said about putting storage into the ground. Permafrost, now he said, is 25 degrees. About the ideal temperature for potato is what, 32 or 34?
Somewhere between 30 and 38.
Okay, we're talking about a temperature gradient of only 7 to 10 degrees here. That means with a very low energy heat source in your underground root cellar, you could keep it home at perfect temperature for sowing potatoes or good beans or carrots or any of your root crops. I don't know. What time?
Well, we lose our permafrost cooling reserve as soon as we go up to 35, 38 degrees to hold for just a year or 5 years. How are we going to retain the permafrost?
Well, I think we're talking about an insulated root cell, first of all, I think.
Eventually, it
migrates out, but remember, the ground is a tremendous heat sink. And it's very, very, it takes a long, long time to change the ground temperature even when you're talking about thermal, being a thermal.
That's what I'm concerned about. I'm thinking about our buildings. We said we're going to cross into the earth and get susceptible. If we put our heat in the earth at 38 degrees, how long will it be before we have actually changed the environment around the world?
I don't think any of us know.
Well, it's not an accurate soil.
It's a temperature difference, 38 to 25 is not enough, so during the course of the year, we're going to change. That will remain warmer at 25, if we're going to have to
take. I mean, what Bob is saying, though, it's not an ice-rich soil, in fact, it doesn't help them make a lot of difference.
Yeah, just eventually you'll get out to a point where there'll just be a temperature spread across some area or some length. I don't know how far from the freezer it can get to above freezing.
But the shifting problems aside, if that happened, wouldn't that be a perfect root cellar? Because now you have the exact temperature you need.
There's some other things that will enter into this now. And that is that if you put your storage area where the ground cover adjacent to your storage area, if that is undisturbed, your outward differentiation heat will be much less than if you were to put it out in the middle of an open field. Because when you put it in an open field, the permafrost will go down about 20 to 25 feet in 10 years. That's been my experience. And then it stabilizes at 25 feet from there on down, it's frozen. From there on up, it's unfrozen. But if you put that in an area, like I say, your ground is undisturbed, you have your moss or your grass or whatever you have, you let that come right up to your foundation footings, then you won't, you'll have a less heat transfer than you would want to do.
There is a method of storing vegetables that could be done in each person's house. It's only a one-time investment of energy if the people could utilize their food in that manner, and that is by drying. And it would work for both their meat and their vegetables. And each household has the capability already to dry its vegetables just by using their own cook stove or their own windows or by their heating stove. If it would be possible to get the eating habit developed. We no longer have any storage problem that would last for several years in case someone didn't plant a garden, and you just have a one-time, you know, you don't have to keep investing in storage facility all year long.
Dehydration has tremendous potential. We haven't done any of it, Kelly. Again, if we had the people and the publication, I keep looking at extension service here and see that these things could be taught and our people would love to learn them.
We need to get us funding for agent particular.
That's a good idea. We're going to the pastor, the one you've got known. That's a lot of news.
Why don't you just write a letter to our committee and request that maybe we can help?
Is that, we know that the reason we haven't gotten more help from the valuable things that corporate extension could do us is because of the funding problem. Is this the way we handle that? Is this the way we can help them with that? Who should we address your letters to?
The chairman, Pat Carney, and I would send a copy to each of the legislative finance chairmen. I believe both of them would be sympathetic, very sympathetic to your need, and that's Russ Meekins for the
I would certainly include their local legislature as well.
Yes. Sure.
Okay, so the key is the state legislature.
Well, they're the people who own the first string.
We'll get their address.
At least for that, you know, for that source of funding anyway. For the extension service, it is.
I'm going to ask before this day is over, might as well mention it now, for a resolution from this conference that more support be given to cooperative extension so that they in turn can have their people help us in what we're trying to do up here.
But I think, Tony, that perhaps what you're looking for are the most efficient ways to go about something like from the start, and ways that are the simplest for the people to include in their existing way of life. And people already dry fish, I believe.
That's true, but the taste of dried vegetables hasn't been acquired yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying I'm opposed to Kelly, I'm saying it's an unknown.
Sure.
And one of the hardest things to do is get people to eat that which is good for them, which they're not used to tasting.
Sure.
Tastes have history. Mm-hmm. No. Like the people in Amber, they cut up their carrots and their shrimps and they put them in cereal with berries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they eat their vegetables.
Sure.
And, you know, we think of that on the South stateside. You ought to have a bulletin out on that,
sir. People around here probably know more, as much or more about drying foods as the average citizen anyway.
Well, drying
fish.
Dry
fish
and meat.
Berries.
Yeah.
Do they dry berries?
I don't know. I don't think they dry berries. Berries don't dry. Berries.
Dried fruits and favorite.
Well, what I was thinking was, if I remember correctly, a lot of people make a kind of a stew sometimes out of their meat. It's really easy to put in dry vegetables in there. You know, just throw it into the pot.
I'd sure like to see somebody introduce this idea to the Eskimo housewife. I'm anxious to see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
You might see some good things happen.
Mm-hmm. Then a person could store their vegetables in their own house.
They'd
still wouldn't be much space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it were food, they'd find a place to put it.
Yeah. Because once it's dry, it doesn't matter if it's frozen or
not. No, it doesn't.
Some small commercial drying racks and things that are available.
Mm-hmm. But that what everyone has here, you know, would work also. You know, just a heating stove or sun.
I think you have some very good ideas there, but like Tony mentioned, you've got an education problem.
Sure.
The experience that my wife had this summer in getting the Eskimo people involved in preserving through canning and freezing, it takes a while for the people to assimilate this. And so they've started on the freezing and canning, not take them into the drying process.
Something is mentioned, it comes around to education. And you know what? This isn't unique here, this business of changing cultural patterns and tastes and so on. After all, look what's gone on in other parts of our society when margarine replaced butter, for example. Not very many people eat butter anymore. And yet, 40 years ago, most Americans did not like margarine whatsoever. But it was an enormous advertising, promotional, educational campaign that made a tremendous change over the past 20, 30 years.
And, we need a Madison Avenue approach.
Possibly so. Possibly so. But I think that's,
Well,
I don't
really,
think it needs to be Madison.
Thing.
It doesn't
Jim?
Need to be Madison Avenue in the sense of a big splash, color ads, and all that sort of thing. Yet the concept of selling a new idea is something that is done through cooperative extension just as much as the transfer of facts.
Well, it was a selling or a teaching job to get the Eskimos to claim gardens.
Yep.
Because they weren't doing it before, and they're doing it now. So, yeah, we're on the same track. To this company, the subject of Lynn is now the only farmer among us. He's a genuine bona fide guy, a farmer, not a Midwestern farmer, but a farmer who spent the last 39 years in the permafrost area. And he's walked over this land. And by the way, I'm a pretty good hiker, but don't try to out hike Lynn and Funk. He can cross that tundra country faster than anybody I ever saw. And he out hiked a couple of Eskimos. People who were with you this summer when you walked up in the top of the river to explore your thing. But Lynn, I want you to tell us about the potential of the land as you see it from a farmer's viewpoint, capability of production.
Well, I've expressed some of my ideas as the discussion has progressed here. I'll say this, that there is no doubt in my mind that what this area, especially the Kobuk River Valley and up around Sullivan, they could produce all the basic food needed in this whole area. There's farmers in the Fairbanks and Delta area that are raising high quality milling wheat right now. My wife and I used some of it last winter. We borrowed a little flour mill and made our own flour, and she baked the bread, and it's as good a bread as good a flour as you can buy in the store. They're raising it there in Fairbanks, and there's no doubt in my mind that what can be raised in Amber and Piana and Sellowick areas.
What's it called?
Is this
gas or wheat, my agent?
No, it's not. It's a better quality. Gas or wheat is a wheat that matures very well, and it's a very good livestock wheat, but it is a low quality flour compared to this other variety. The name of it, it slips my mind right at the moment. But you can, on the average, you can get 60 bushel per acre of wheat, and there on up to 75. I have grown, in years gone by, I have grown 95 bushel of barley to the acre. And barley is a very good livestock feed. You can feed the hogs, and cattle, and poultry. They do very well on it. potato production, Dr. Dearborn, in his remarks, pointed out the production that you can get of carrots. I brought Tony a little bag of carrots. I wish I'd had room to have brought more. This year we have carrots about this long, about that big around, tremendous yield of carrots. And another thing that could be done, as you drive along the highways in interior Alaska, especially from Fairbanks to Anchorage and out of Delta, there's this white clover and yellow clover is coming in along the roadways. In Utah, where I was born and raised, they had large acreage of this yellow and white clover. They produced seed and also life, the pulp or the stock of the plant. After they took the seed off, they used it for livestock feed, and it's very efficient. Cattle don't like it as well as they do alfalfa hay, but it's a very good feed. And it's growing wild along the highways, and it could be cultivated. We get it in the Selwick area. They could have hundreds of acres of that. They could sell the seed to the lower 48 and put bees in there and produce honey. This year I had two stands of bees at my place there in Fairbanks, and last Saturday I extracted the honey, and the wife and I, we got 7.5 gallons out of the two hives. This year, as much rain as we've had in this area and in the Fairbanks area, I was surprised that we got any. I was expecting, being away all summer, I wasn't expecting to get very little. And then when I got into the hives and extracted it, and that I took just the top of the hive, the top box. I have two boxes. One is the brood chamber, and the top box is the honey chamber. So I'm planning to run an experiment this winter of keeping my bees over winter. This is the first time that I've ever tried that. There have been other people who have tried it a time or two. It hasn't been successful, but I worked with a Norwegian, a man that was born and raised in Norway and was over there most of his life, and then he came to this country. And his cousin was a beekeeper, and he made his living at it, and he gave me some ideas on how to keep bees. They keep their bees year round over there. And they have about the same season that we have. He puts his bees in his bee storage area in the wintertime around between the 15th of September and the 1st of October, and takes them out around the 1st of May, and that's about what we have in this area. So I'm going to try it, and if it doesn't work out, well, I'll know. If it does, well, I'll know what it costs, whether it's feasible or not. So. And there's another thing I might mention, the possibility of growing domestic geese for the villages. Now, geese, wild geese and domestic geese both live on grass. Domestic geese, and you have to feed them a couple of weeks on mash, grain mash. Then you put them out on grass, and then they're on grass all summer long, and in the fall, you butcher them, and you have very little investment in them. And the villages all have large areas of natural grass where they can raise any number of geese that they want to raise, and that would be a good source of food. And eggs, you could have your own chickens, keep them year-round once you get into your grain production. Point that Dr. Dearborn brought out about the rain, your water, getting the water on the crops at the right time is very important. Of course, nature took care of that this summer. We had an abundant supply of rain, but there are times when you do need to have irrigation as a backup. So I don't know what else I could say along with the comments that I've already made.
What about the land that you helped select and the way you see that it should be brought under?
As I visited these villages, I was looking, being a farmer at heart and done a lot of farming, I was looking for potential agricultural land, and as I came to the villages, I spotted these various areas, and when I mentioned it in Ambler, and then one of the villagers there in Ambler, Nano Corporation, asked him not to farm anymore in the homestead that he had selected and had done some gardening on, because it was in an area of historical artifacts, and so they asked him not to farm there and asked him to locate in another area. So I was able to help select another area in that, and as it turned out, the area that I selected for them, and they're in the process of getting it to the village council and through now, is much better location than what he had. It's prime agricultural land. It's up off of the valley, far enough to be out of the early summer frost. well, they really fall for us, and it's up high enough that it's a gentle south slope, and it's prime agricultural land, and the same thing is true in Silhouette. I mentioned to the mayor when I was there the first time helping plant their garden that the possibility or the feasibility of getting some into the full-time farming aspect, and I mentioned that I could see from the village up in the hills that it looked to me like would be good land, and then as I flew over it going out, I noticed it, and then I came to, my wife and I came to a Kotzebue over the 4th of July, and while we were here, the mayor and the seller called Tony and asked him to send us back up there to help them select this land, so Tony went with me. We selected some land there that's prime agricultural land.
Is that tree covered or grass covered?
Both. Tundra and tree. My ideas of bringing this tundra in cultivation is I would like to try, there's two ways you can do it, and that is to take a bulldozer and shear in the wintertime when the ground is frozen, shear the brush. If you have timber, it's the only way to go, to shear the timber off during the freeze-up, and then put it in small windrows and burn it the following year, and then spread the ash and disc and till and put a tiller on it. But there's a two-year time lag doing it that way, from the time you start your clearing until you take off your first crop. There's no other way to go. It's impractical to put enough fertilizer on your ground the first year after you clear it to get a good crop on a large area. It's better to disc it and till it and let the air and soil bacteria work, organisms work for one summer, then start your farm production. But there, I've been doing a lot of thinking, and I've done a small-scale experiment in Ambler. we broke out some three different garden spots. Well, we enlarged a lot of gardens, in fact, but these three areas I worked on, and with the idea in mind of trying to find a faster way of bringing this land under cultivation or making it productive. One area we had a large garden about half the size of this room. We tilled it, I tilled it several times, go over it, was virgin ground and had a lot of vegetation, a lot of grass in it. I tilled it in and worked it just as deep as the tiller would go. And then two other areas, were smaller areas, but I like the one plot was compacted. I walked over it and it was almost firm as when I first started tilling it. The other two that I had a lot of good application of fertilizer, I walked over it and it was just as mellow and fluffy as the day that I finished tilling it. And the difference there is that nitrogen fertilizer. I sunk in up almost to my ankles and that had nitrogen fertilizer on it. So there's a possibility there. I talked to Dr. Dearborn today, this morning he came in and about the feasibility of putting nitrogen on. Of course, something a little bit new, and he said that it appeared to him that that would be the way to go. So if that is the case, I'll know next spring when those people plant those garden plots what the answer is. But if that turns out the way I think it will, then we, on this tundra, you can cut 1 year off your time lag from the time you start cultivating until you get your first harvest. So that would be quite important. So if you have any other questions, I'll see whether I can answer them or not.
What temperature are you going to try to keep your bees at?
Between 45 and 50 degrees.
What are you going to be doing differently with the bees than what you've done in the past?
Beg pardon?
What are you going to be doing differently with the bees in terms of the...
Well, the other people that have tried to winter over, they've just left them out in an unprotected area. Just a normal hive.
They're not covered or anything?
They didn't cover it or anything. And the bees, one fellow, he said he's... the bees made it through the winter, but the hive was so weak by springtime that they didn't do anything. And, so I have a little shed that I'm going to insulate, 8 inches of insulation, all top, sides, and bottom. Now I'll have a little heater in there set on the thermostat, and I'm going to put a meter, electric meter in there, so I can measure the amount of electricity that I use through the winter to see what.
I used to raise bees, and I wasn't as generous as you. I would take the two top supers and leave the bottom. But I kept mine in the, I built a little place in the chicken house, and there's enough heat that comes off the chickens to get the bees very warm. So that's another thought, you know, rather than go through the expense of putting a heater in, just put them in on the chimney.
Where's your home at?
Well, this was down the Midwest.
Well, how about the noise from the chickens and from the people?
Didn't bother. No, the biggest enemies I had, moths got into bees really bad, mice and skunks.
Yeah.
Skunk will wipe out a hive. But you don't have that problem.
Right. You don't have. You do have a bear problem, but not in the wintertime. The first stand of high, bees I got, I was working night shift at one of the airlines, and I came home this morning. We'd had the bees about 3 weeks, and they were beginning to make honey. And when I first came to Alaska, my wife, she wasn't interested in hunting or guns or anything, and I had quite a collection of guns at that time. And I came home this one morning, I worked night shift, and she had all my guns out, and she was trying to put shotgun shells in my rifle because a bear had been in there and wiped out our bees. But in the wintertime, we won't have bears, but in the spring, you'll have a bear problem, probably. Any other questions?
I have one. Will you and your wife be working at the Cobalt next year?
I don't know. She wants to come back, and I would enjoy coming back, but we'll have to see what develops. I've been trying for the last 4 or 5 years to sell out at Fairbanks and go someplace where it's warm in the wintertime. But so far, I haven't been able to get out.
What kind of bees do you use?
I have what they call a Caucasian bee. They're not quite as easy to work with as the Italian bee, but they do produce more a better crop of honey in cool weather, as this season very well testifies to that. Well, that's the impression, and that's what you read in all the books printed in America. But this Norwegian told me that he put his bees in the bunker, he called it, but it was an underground cement building, built in the side of the hill and then covered over with dirt. It was a long, narrow building, and he had 400 or 500 hives in this one building. He would put his bees in there in the fall, and he put sugar in one container in front of the hive, and in front of each hive, he'd have sugar and water in different containers. And the only time they had light in there is when he went to service them. And those bees would come out of the hive and eat what sugar they wanted, and drink what water they wanted, and went back in the hive. And they were in there from 1st of October to 1st of May. And he raised them all the time. And I'm sure they didn't do any flying in the dark there in the wintertime. So I don't know.
There are two.
Yes, it is, but here in this area, you'd have more of a problem getting the bees in the spring than you would there in Anchorage and Fairbanks. Like we, one day from Texas to Fairbanks, and your bees are there, and that's all right, but you'd have at least 2 days and maybe three before you could get them in the Cold Buck Valley.
When we get bees in this area, in this park, I don't know, quite open, they're natural.
Was that right?
Sure. Bees. The ones that have survived, I think, that I don't know, are black and white.
Are they a honeybee?
No,
are they a honeybee?
No, bumblebee.
He's talking
about well, okay. We have those over in Fairbanks, but not
talking about honeybees. Somebody's going to try and overwinter about 200 hives this winter in Fairbanks. Some brother did. About 200 hives.
This year?
Yeah.
Is that right?
In Fairbanks.
Who is it? Would Virgil know who that is?
Virgil.
I'm going to get a hold of him. I love to experiment. I'm always experimenting in my garden this year with the fertilizer experiments. And my potato crop was almost a flop this year because I changed my fertilizer. But my carrot crop was tremendous.
Back to fertilizer. I don't know much about fertilizer. I wonder, are there ways to minimize the amount of fertilizer that you need to bring in? It's quite expensive.
It sure is.
One of the things I've been concerned about is if you have to bring in, say, even 200 pounds, 300 pounds per acre, you're talking about a lot of money.
That's right.
Remember what cement for a project that we built. And it wouldn't matter whether or not the cement was given to me. It cost 15 times as much to bring here as it did by the cement, so.
But to start out with, there's no other way to go. But as you get into it, then you get crop residue, you can start your compost piles, and the larger your project, well, the larger your compost piles, and compost does work if you work at it. And it's very effective. But to start out with, you just have to make that investment. For 400 acres for the nitrogen fertilizer alone, it would be $30,000. But 2 years or 3 years from now, it'll probably be four times that much.
There's another approach too, and that's to plant some green manuring. Over in Galena, they're raising alfalfa over there, and it's a brand of alfalfa that they developed north of Saskatoon, about 300 miles. And you could get, in a course of a year, you can get almost all the nitrogen through some peas or alfalfa or some legume crop like that.
Well, there's a yellow blossomed alfalfa that they developed there. They got it. It came from Russia originally. Dr. George Gasser brought it in many, many years ago, and he planted it at Rampart. That's yellow blossomed alfalfa. It's not quite as it doesn't quite produce quite as much tonnage per acre as the other types of alfalfa, but it does winter over. And this clover, yellow blossom and white blossom, sweet clover they call it, is a very high legume plant. And it, as you get into your agriculture and your crop rotation, you can build up your soil fertility where you don't have to ship this in. To start out with, you just have to ship it in.
Has anyone up there experimented with the use of fish waste?
My wife uses fish fertilizer that she buys out of the store and mixes with water and puts on her plants, and it's very effective.
So what about all the fish?
The Denslows, there in Amber, they make their own fertilizer out of fish. They put it in barrels and then ferment, and it's very effective.
So that would be a possibility for
Sure is.
Lena Satterley, one of the most successful gardeners for years and years, one of the few people who could do it probably for decades now, pipe spit out here, uses fish, but she does a different thing with it. She cooks it first. And then she puts it on the garden, decomposes very, very rapidly, and she gets immediate use in it, just like that.
There's one problem with putting the fish itself, just take a whole fish and put in the soil, eventually you'll build up enough residue oil that it's detrimental to the ground. But if you have some way of getting rid of that oil, which cooking would do it, you could do that.
That would be a thing to start.
You gotta have better fence too if you have much fence left.
I have
a
question.
Sure would. That's something that could be developed as you develop your fish resource here in Kotzebue. Save the waste products and process it in such a way that you could people up the valley could use that. They could bring their own. They could have their own barge, small barges, and come down in the fall and bring their vegetables and take their fish fertilizer back with them on the river. And you could eliminate a lot of it. Another thing, over in the Anatubic Pass area, there's a phosphate deposit over there that's. I haven't seen it myself, but I know people personally who have seen it. In fact, Sig Ween, Ween Airlines, he was the original, he staked that area with the idea of hauling it, the phosphate out in airplanes, because he was an airplane man. But, that phosphate, the raw natural phosphate, is 30%. And then lower 48, you get phosphate after you process it with sulfuric acid one time. You get 20%, and then you put it through a process enough times, you get it up to 48%. But here, this phosphate bed over in Anatubic is 30% right to start. So those people over there could develop that phosphate industry and trade back and forth or sell to the other natives, and we're economically self-sufficient if we urbanize.
I think that's probably in the National Monument.
Is it? I think the native people selected that area. The Barrow people selected that area, so it's on native land.
There's one phosphate area that is in the National Monument. So
could be.
Curious about your wife's work. Did she confine herself to showing the village women how to handle the crop?
She worked right along with me in the planting. I ran the tiller and tried to instruct the native people how to run the tiller, and then we'd get right in and plant them, and then our second time around, where she showed them how to process the mm-hmm. cauliflower properly. And make sauerkraut out of cabbage.
Mm-hmm. Like the jars. There must have been a problem getting the jars for canning.
Well, there was a few jars available that they had there. Mark Cleveland had a few jars that he had brought in. And then they had, one type of mayonnaise jar that a Kerr Mason lid will fit on very well. They had some of those.
And the stores sell the lids.
And then we had plastic containers for putting it in the freezer, too.
And those are available in the villages?
Yes. My wife and I as soon as we were asked to come over here, we sent an order to Sears and got 500 containers, and then Tony reimbursed us for it, and we put them in the various villages, three villages.
Did she just go from home to home as people invited her?
We tried to. She did a couple times in private homes, and then she had a local demonstration, that is, in the clinic or a private home, and then have the other women in the village come there.
Did that work well?
And it worked out pretty well. Mm-hmm. She got good response. We was hoping that they would more of the women would turn out, but they got. She felt quite well satisfied with the turnout that she did. And they seem to be quite enthusiastic about it. Anything else?
I think that kind of participation that Mr. and Mrs. Funk offered to the Kobuk Valley was really invaluable, as I can see it. They filled a role that no one else had the capability of filling. And I'm wondering if they're not going to be doing that again next year, who's going to fill that void?
We don't know what the future holds, but I'm glad you brought that up, Kelly. I wish you folks could have heard the reaction of villagers after the funks of paying the village for it. It took about 3 days, I guess, for them to discover you and to discover what you could do and who you were. They said to me something like this in their own way. Where the heck have these people been all the time? Why haven't you sent them here soon? And are they coming back? And I said, well, I'm coming back, if I can get them back, or others. Actually, it was kind of an experiment. I told you, I was in prison about sending these people out in the first place. Turned out they camped out, they ran it, they adapted, they fought mosquitoes, they lived like Eskimos.
Well, we pioneered Alaska. The village conditions weren't much different than what we first went to when we first came to Alaska. We went down on our first home. I used hung blankets in the doorways because hadn't had time to put the doors in. And we had a propane stove and a cook stove, and I made a furnace out of barrels. I'm being a mechanic. I'm also a welder, so I put together a barrel of smoke and heated my house. And I had a stove together that would hold the fire for 24 hours. That's pretty awesome.
What year was that?
We had two rooms in the past, running water in the creek.
I should tell you, I just found out something that he did in Amber that I didn't know until yesterday. He's very modest, it's hard to get him out. But Amber had a problem. They had a washout on the main road that went to the airport. And the washout stayed there most of the summer. Well, Lynn got tired of people not being able to cross it, and everybody being inconvenienced and not being able to haul their freight and passengers back and forth. The cats, as usual, were broken down. Usually heavy equipment is broken down if you find it in the road. Lynn repaired the cat, and he went up there and repaired the road. I don't know how long it took him, but it happened very fast. He didn't use up much time at all. But the kind of people that we need in the village are Lynn's type, and they're hard to find these days. They're generous. They're people who are close to the land and close to the equipment and who do, as traditional Alaskans have to do, a little bit of everything in order to just keep things running, just being good at maintenance and good at being, oh, like Jen's note, what would you call it, resourceful? You need something to build it. And Lynn is that, and Neva is just, no, you've got to leave her, she's something else. You want, I wish you were here. Anyway, enough about Lynn's farm. In winding up here, just before we break for lunch, I hope that each of you here have gotten the message that we're on to something so big, none of us alone, even as an organization, can handle it. We've done a lot of learning and developing in the last 3 years with the Marston Garden Project, but I want to tell you this. We've uncovered more questions than we have answers. We've answered a lot of questions, but for every question that's been answered, there's been two questions raised, two new ones. And now it's broadening, and this thing is getting so big, and it has so much exciting potential. We don't know what to do with it, frankly. The whole Marston Foundation isn't big enough to touch a fraction of it. We've gotten a start, and again, I'm going to repeat it throughout the conference. We need your help. We need your involvement. And before this day is over, I want to hear from each of you, and I want to hear you say in your own words and your own ideas for just a few minutes what you can do for us and with us while we help you achieve your own organizational objectives. It's got to be a two-way thing. We're not here to just take and not give. Dr. Dearborn's been involved with us for 3 years, and we hope he's learned a lot more about the betas than he otherwise would have. He helped us learn about the betas, and we helped him with his breeding trials. And so it was a thing which helped us both. And this is the kind of arrangement we'd like to get with all these organizations that are represented here. Community College, we want to hear from you today. We want to hear how you see you can be involved. The New York Association, Cooperative Extension, Dr. Drew's shop, University, we don't know. I can't even tell you, I don't even know the resources we have enough. And Pete, we're going to get into agronomy and grasses. We're going to get into the idea of domestic meat production and producing hay and silage and corn. I don't know about this area, but you're going to tell us a little bit about it. Hopefully we'll share something and discover something. So stay tuned. Let's go eat lunch, but let's try to be back here about 1:15.
A little bit of beef, red meat program at Homer, grazing trials. We're engaged, Dr. Mitchell, particularly, is engaged to a great extent of working with some of the native grasses in Alaska, what grasses are adapted to what areas, their productivity, their forage potential, revegetation, and some of these things. And I'm sorry, these few slides I won't be able to show you. We have a soils lab at Palmer, and we have the ability there to run most of the nutrients. There was a question this morning that excuse me, came up on how we might save some money on fertilizer. Certainly, instead of buying 1,000 pounds extra fertilizer, it may be worthwhile to spend $3 on a soils test. So, when you send a soil sample in through the Extension Service, it winds up at the shop there in Palmer, and we have a lab there that analyzes it, sends out a report on various nutrients levels, and then goes back to the Extension Service, who makes recommendations to you as individuals and cooperators throughout the state. We do have a lot of expertise there. We've got people working with grains. grasses. I don't bring much expertise to you today. I guess I come to get your questions to tote home. But I'll share with you anything I can. In terms of grains and things, there's Frank Woody at Fairbanks and Roscoe Taylor at Mount Miska has done an awful lot. And certainly, these are the people that you need to tap to see what you should be doing, what are their recommendations. I know a few of the things they're planning around there, but I can't talk to you about, you know, what you should be putting in. And Dr. Mitchell is the one that should be talking to you about what grasses. I've been working with him for the past 8 years. A lot of the things I know, and some of the things I probably don't know, and some of the things I never will know. But the thing that I would like to share with you, probably more than anything, is some of the things closer to here, and this is a soil and range survey that we've been conducting in this region since 76. 76, NANA was able to acquire funds, basically, well, several different sources, but there was a state legislature appropriation made possible for the range and soil survey to begin. They wanted just some basic answers of what are our resources so they can make some intelligent decisions on how to use them. Aren't we? Oh, there we are. Okay. In 76, the area that was covered runs down the Baldwin Peninsula to about 160 degrees, which I believe is this line here, including the Buckman part of the Buckman River drainage down the Bentland Mountains. Past Newbrook Lake and over on the mountains here down the Fish River. Comprises about 3.5 million acres, I guess. This summer, we covered the area picking up against the Fish River along the divide here down to Fox River. And there was interest in NANA. Flight for permit and obtain that permit to use the Koyuk River drainage here. So we surveyed probably a million acres in there. Of course, we start talking about millions of acres going in the next slide here. We're talking about something other than conventional mapping techniques because we just can't go out there and walk over a million acres. That's a big chunk of the territory. So we used satellite products. Tom George, the geophysical, was involved. It was basically a soil conservation project, soil conservation service project. This is Jim Preston, the state range conservation school, was retired and then replaced by Wisconsin. The color product here that we're using is a computer-enhanced digital image. And the colors on that product say that these areas have similar reflective values. In other words, when the sun shines down on the surface of the earth and reflects back, these areas that are color-coded are similar in reflective value. So all we did was use this as a guide and we said, okay, what is orange? You can't really see the colors there. I should have thought about that more. There's dark green and light green and yellow and orange. So we would fly over these areas in a helicopter and land and try to describe the vegetated community there and the soils. And of course, just like the gold resources, they wanted to know what was where, same thing with the vegetation, so try and find the resources that people have. Here we're working within a frame, just listing the plants that we have there and obtaining figures on the production. How much does that particular piece of grain yield? There's all kinds of ranges. Lots of different classifications of tundra. You can bust it up as fine as you want to. We've been surveying millions of acres, and so we use some pretty gross the mediation is just because of necessity. Surely the predominant resource that you have up there is what we have delineated as Tussock Tundra. And in 76, about 40% of the area is composed of this type. So this is really your resource. You have to learn what you can do with 40% of the area. You can do something with this, the rest of it. It's fine, but that's probably 40% of the land right now. For the Kobuk River, it may not be at all. I don't know. I haven't done it that way. The pictures I saw lots of trees and stuff, so I don't, not being over the area. And in fact, it may not be true for the area we surveyed this summer. We haven't tabulated anything. So I don't know about it. This Tussock Tundra type is certainly critical. Other types of tundra, the brushy drainages, an excellent habitat for moose. And this is the thing about just a basic inventory that we conducted, is that it has suitability for determining reindeer carrying capacity,